Well, Horace, it's been a while. I want to explore a couple things today, and I know you have a few items as well. Some recent travel has sort of sparked a question in my mind about, you know, what ignites the change that starts the avalanche. And I want to recount a story when I was in a car in New York recently, and I used a different service, but the driver had a new iPhone and the Uber app on his dashboard. And so I asked him about this, and he told me that Uber gave him a $500 check and a new iPhone and the app in return for a 30-day trial, and then the right to take $10 out of his checking account each month, and of course the 20% cut on his rides through Uber. So I was thinking about that along with you know, what's been a very good year in the car business, and the term cash on the hood, right? So the cash incentive, you know, here's $1,000 for buying this $30,000 car, or $5,000 for a $50,000 SUV. And sort of on the other end of that spectrum of driving change, last week BMW's sales and marketing boss talked about apparently there's discussions that London and Paris may ban diesel cars in the urban areas. And he's saying, you know, before we jump into this in 2 or 3 years to reach these targets, it's going to take much longer than 2 to 3 years. So yeah. So here we have examples of money, right? You know, cash in the hood or a check versus regulation or taxes. I mean, there's all sorts of things. So what, as we've looked at the glacial pace over the past couple of years of change in the auto industry, you know, and you've had your observations, what is that spark? You know, what will it be? Or is it a series of sparks that might drive the change? And I have a few other examples as we talk as well. So what do you think?
Yeah, you know, great stories. I mean, these are all fascinating subtopics. I mean, the question about Uber and their willingness to spend to acquire
channels, essentially.
This is to acquire customers through the acquisition of cars. Or sort of, actually, they're solving the supply problem, not the demand problem. I think the demand problem is taking care of itself.
They're poaching from their competitors.
So it's like a turf war happening on where the turf are potential the drivers, and they're battling globally on this, right? So they're having to fight a battle for each territory separately because the rules are different in each territory. So it kind of gives you one that study of Uber is a sort of a wonderful case study of the whole industry, because you can see how transportation is so dependent on local effect, local regulations, local
They have behaviors. A sales force, right? I mean, they have people. That's what impressed me. I thought, you know, this isn't somebody discovering Uber, you know, this was an early 30s Russian guy in a brand new nice car, successful. His father had been a driver for many years. And so obviously they found him. And that tells you a lot.
Yeah, money is suddenly awash. You know, it's right. Flowing into this sector, and so, you know, there's always been taxi business has gone through, you know, the medallions in New York. I don't know how much they're going for. There's actually there's a story I read about medallions prices that have somewhat collapsed since Uber came, but nobody really knows because there isn't really a market
ticker. Public market, right? Exactly.
You can't just watch this clearly. There's some site supposedly that gets some of this inside info, but these are non-public transactions. So there's a question about the market itself. These medallions were running in the hundreds of thousands at least, right? And same thing in Paris. The same thing in, I'm sure, in London, because these are, you have a fixed number of cabs allowed per city, and yet the demand of rides is anything but fixed. It could vary wildly, and I think that's where Uber comes in and says, you know, why have a fixed resource like taxis and taxi drivers when the demand is highly volatile, changes during the day, changes based on which day, changes constantly. So they just stepped in and said, you know, we're going to be market makers for a fundamentally broken market model, right? That they're just stepping in, and that is obvious, and but it's still causing a huge amount of disruption in the sense of change that cannot be absorbed by the system, and so everything's getting thrown at it, including allegations of safety, allegations of bad behavior,
price games, of course, you know,
pricing games, and breaking the rules, right? That the laws do not permit this, and so there's definitely a reaction from the incumbents of serious, you know, confrontation. On the other topic that you brought up, which is the diesel thing, it's fascinating how there too the regulations are the ones that are swinging the industry, and how do you cope with this? Because in one year you're told that diesel is the future because it has lowest or highest efficiency, lowest impact on the environment, and then the next year you're told that. And you, by the way, could be the consumer. The consumer is told this, as well as the manufacturer, that diesel is the better choice, a green choice, and indeed it's the economical choice. What the state giveth, the state taketh away. The giving was that, you know, will encourage diesel vehicles to some degree, but in Europe, for example, tax or the cost of diesel is less than the cost of gas or petrol. But the problem is that you pay a higher vehicle tax, and the vehicle tax is typically a pollution tax. So that's assessed on the CO2 usually, but there's a different assessment for diesel altogether. So it doesn't make sense, unless you drive a lot of miles, that you go with a diesel car. And again, this varies by country. And in Germany, for example, you don't pay a yearly tax on the diesel car, but you pay an upfront sales tax that's a lot higher. So there's all kinds of ways of sort of moving incentives, paying at the pump, paying on a yearly basis, paying up front in terms of tax alone. And then, of course, the vehicles tend to be a little bit more expensive to make. So you do have that higher price, but they last longer. So as a consumer, you sort of, do I pay now so I can get a car that lasts me longer? And it's the economics and just the calculations are really beyond the average person. They cannot, right. You cannot sit there and say with a spreadsheet that I'm gonna make a better decision by buying a diesel car. And then what happened is then they pulled the rug out even if you did all that work, and then one day say, well, you can't drive in the city center with this car because it pollutes too much on a particular type of pollutant that we didn't tell you about before. So it's not the usual kind of pollution. You know, carbon is considered CO2 emissions that are causing global warming. But in this case, it's a particular kind of, I guess, nitrous oxide, which is not carbon dioxide, but nitrous oxide in a small particulate matter that may have some health effects and might have some kind of other polluting effects that are considered harmful. So the rules are changing on the manufacturers, on the consumer, as the industry gets sort of swung around by these regulators. So it's unfortunate. And then, by the way, the regulators that are acting on these quotas in Europe are being pressured because there've been these kind of global or continent-wide quotas on pollution. The harmful effects of pollution supposedly on people and health being damaged by these gases, not on CO2. There's nothing to do with CO2. This is all to do with some statistical analysis saying that so many people suffer from health problems due to these particulates, and so I, you know, it's very, very difficult to make decisions as a result. It's difficult for the consumer. It's difficult for the manufacturer, and then you end up with potential losses, unanticipated losses, right? Because the rules are changing.
Sure, wrong product at the wrong time at the wrong price. All those things.
Yeah, so it's a miserable business. Mm-hmm. You have to kind of shake your head at it and say, how is anything going to ever happen here? This is why. I mean, one thing I should mention, by the way, I know you had those questions, but I have kind of my own as well. It's like I actually went through and did a Tesla test drive.
Yes, yes.
And
segue
so
to that. Yes,
there's a couple interesting observations of it. Here's a company that's trying to also live within this crazy automotive world. And try to make an impact. And the interesting thing with Tesla is that, many things. One thing is, by the way, we're in the middle. For those of you listeners that are tuning in at some time far into the future, that just recognize that oil prices have just collapsed, and they might be back up by the time you're listening. But they fell to something around $60 a gallon, a barrel, right? Yeah, $60 a barrel from over 110, I think. So nearly half, and it's causing chaos in all kinds of ways. One of the victims is actually Tesla, because Tesla's stock price has also collapsed along with the price of oil, or maybe collapse is the wrong word. It has declined dramatically, and here you have yet another. Factor in the potential prospects of an innovator, a company that tries to do things differently, and suddenly they're being affected by commodity pricing, which is itself being affected by the introduction of new techniques for oil drilling in the United States, and these new drilling companies, which are
fracking and all that.
Yeah, but they're literally wild. Like the old term was wildcatters. These guys would come in and tap wells nearby an established well, which meant that they're really going into the same deposit. But that doesn't apply. It's not that type of wildcatters, but it's this kind of sudden surge in production that's occurred in the U.S. now is the number one producer of oil in the world. And so we're in a topsy-turvy world. We're in a bizarro world where the U.S. is actually exporting oil, and OPEC is in trouble. And along with OPEC is Russia, who is another large producer, and they're suffering some serious trauma right now. I was just reading about the oil industry in the North Atlantic, which is European, UK, North Sea, I should have said. And they're suffering as well, having layoffs, cutting back on CapEx. So things can get very dramatic very quickly, and Tesla is being swept, you know, through this. And of course, it'll probably turn around. You don't know when, and the answer usually is that you shouldn't become seduced by the low oil price. Things will get back.
We've seen the movie before. So the interesting thing about your Tesla experience, as I recall, was again the role of regulation and let's say nation state in the portability of the vehicle and the maintenance and all these things. And then I have a segue to another related topic. But so you are not a Tesla owner, Horace, though?
No, I'm not an owner, but I wanted to get a good feel of the car. And so I mean, there's a lot of things you learn from the test drive that you couldn't learn from other sources. And I'll tell you my impressions, which I don't think were captured on by others. So one thing is that the whole thing is running an operating system. It's a Linux operating system. As a result, it has a permanent 3G connection. Because it has a permanent 3G connection, a lot of interesting things can happen. One is that the car can be remotely diagnosed. So one issue with a car like that, which you have to spend a lot of money for, and which doesn't have a dealership network, is how are you going to get repairs done? So this is a very basic ownership question. How do I get repairs done? Who's an authorized repair center? How many places can I go to get things fixed? And this is their official answer. Number one, I think they said something like 80%, maybe 70, I don't know, but it was a big number. A large percent of their repairs are actually things that they diagnose and upload. So they upload fixes. Or they upload.
Sure, they're phoning home all along your experience. Yes,
right.
Yes.
So they're supposedly able to keep you out of the shop by simply tapping in or logging into your car remotely while you sleep, and then finding the problem and telling you about pushing an answer, a solution out. Another thing is that because it has a lot less braking that happens, the number of parts that are wearing out on the car are very limited.
Right.
Having said that, though, these cars have not been on the road that long, so that they haven't been tested to the breaking point. So there's been very few cars. So one question I ask, well, how long will the battery pack last, and how much will it cost to replace it? And they couldn't give me an answer to either of those questions, because they said not all the battery packs they've ever built are still in use. Or if they've been taken out, I suppose it's because of some fault, not because they wore out. And so the wearing out of the battery pack has been something they cannot predict. Even the ones that have lasted quite a long time and have been used for hundreds of thousands of miles, they're saying that they're keeping their life or they're not degrading at all. In fact, they said, this is another thing I learned, is that their intellectual property is not so much in the drivetrain or even the motor or the battery, but rather in the battery maintenance. So knowing how to charge, how to control the charge.
Software layer. There's your injection again, Horace.
Exactly. So it's about the software. And I said, so the reason this came up is because I was watching the gauge. There's a gauge that shows essentially current coming out of the motor or out of the batteries into the motor, and then vice versa, out of the motor into the batteries when you're regenerating. And so you lift off the gas, and then the needle points down into sort of, so the needle is sort of, let's say, horizontally, means that there's nothing going on. That's zero net change in the battery. If it goes up, you're consuming the battery. If it goes down, it's charging the battery. Now, I noticed that on the downscale, there's sort of the opposite of a red line. There's a yellow line. You know, the red line used to mean where your revs would peak or you shouldn't go beyond. But there's this yellow line in terms of the charging. So below a certain threshold, I asked them, why is there a yellow line? So does that mean that I cannot charge faster than a certain limit? And he said, correct. The answer is that the limit and control how much charge is placed into the battery through regenerative braking. And the reason, he said, was that it's a function of temperature. It's a function of battery condition and all these other parameters that they're monitoring. So, for example, we started off on a drive in relatively cold weather, so they wouldn't let the charge go into or the braking to fill the batteries too quickly. And he also said that obviously that's going to be also impacted by when you plug in the car to be charged. And he also said there was another selection you could make on the car's setup screen. And that was that you should not charge more than 80% of the capacity of the batteries. And that's counterintuitive because, you know, all our phones are like, get it to 100%. If right. I could get it to 110%, I will, right? You want to get that battery as full as you can. And their answer is actually, no, you should not get your battery full. And that was crazy. I said, why would you? He said, well, again, because of longevity.
Longevity, exactly. I could see.
He said that. Now, we don't stop you from taking it to 100. We just have a recommended level at 80. You can override that. And if you do, though, be aware that it's going to get reset down after a couple of days. So the idea is that you charge it above 80, or let's say all the way to 100, because you're going to go on a long trip. And as you know, you want to max out the range. But on a day-to-day drive, that they only recommend that you fill it at 80%. That's fascinating. I thought, wait a minute. So you're rating this car at certain number of you know, kilowatts, but it's like you're giving me the capacity of the end of the battery, but you're actually recommending that people only fill it up at 80%, and that's the operating those are the operating principles of the car, that it's actually never full unless you force it to get full. And you know, how many people really remember to do that? And I'm off on a special long distance trip, so I'm gonna, or I'm filling up and I'm gonna override the default. So there's some experience issues here, user experience issues that I think need to be addressed. That they set defaults that are maybe counterintuitive, and so
well, better for them, and maybe not as good as for the quote owner, right?
Well, the owner ends up really with a car that doesn't have the range.
The range that they're advertising, right? Exactly.
Yeah, and so I don't, you know, I understand the logic of it, but there's some. The other thing that's interesting, okay, which was brought home, is that the car is very heavy. Now, you can get the weight from them and so on, but when you experience it, is that it's fairly large on the outside and not so large on the inside. Although it's plenty of room on the inside, but it's got this potential volume of car that's a bit more than it needs to be. And you also see it in wheels. If you ever have large wheels on the car, it's usually because you have a lot of weight in the car. People think that's because it looks good. But in fact, heavy cars need more wheel because they have to deal with cornering forces that are much higher. So you've got to keep that grip, right? So a heavy car with skinny tires will be out of control. So that's one reason why wheels have been getting bigger on cars lately. It's because the weight's been going up. And the interesting thing about the weight is that also the shape of the car is very conventional. So when I stepped back and thought about it and said, hang on, open the front of the frunk, they call it. This is the bonnet in English. but where the engine used to be, and there's no engine, right? Well, of course there's no engine because the engine is a little motor
that
sits right in the back, essentially between the two rear wheels. And so, but then I say, oh, that's cool, you get more storage up front. But then you ask the question, wait a minute, why is there a frunk at all? they designed this car so that it has a shape that is reminiscent of a front engine car.
Traditional car, right.
So instead, they ended up with a car that looks like a car that should have an engine but doesn't have an engine, because a lot of the cars are designed that way because of the components inside. You know, you build around that, the body of the car. In this case, they built it actually, this is I find surprising, they built it so that it looks good. But what looks good is what people associate with what looks good, right?
It's familiar, right.
And if you look at the other car brands, like we talked before about this, the BMW
i3, right.
The Leaf, mm-hmm. and now the FCV, which is
the Toyota,
mm-hmm. the Mirai,
right.
from Toyota, they all look really odd. I mean, they really are taking took an ugly pill or something. But but I think that's a deliberate choice the designers made to have these cars look distinctive. The Volt sort of looks conventional, but it does have an engine. So here we have this question in my mind, is that Tesla and even Fiskars have designed cars that appeal to our sensibilities about what cars should look like, rather than saying, let's build around this new...
Sure, the job to be done, right?
Yeah, because if you go back in time, go back and understand the history of Volkswagen Beetle. It was designed at a time because they put the engine in the rear, and so that freed up the front to be aerodynamically shaped so that it had this teardrop shape. And also, it... you know, it's very cab forward for its day, right? So the packaging of the vehicle is such that you know, first, where's the engine? Second, where are the passengers? And then you build the car to fit that, because it didn't look like anything before. It just completely, I mean, when the Beetle showed up, it must have looked like it was a spaceship. And the same thing, by the way, with the Citroën, the 2CV And to the same extent, somewhat the Mini, that here's a marvel of packaging that they didn't build it to a design spec or a aesthetic. They built it because it had to fit people and an engine. And here's a Tesla saying, we have to fit people and no engine, and we're going to make it look like it has one. The other thing that it has, which is, again, an optical illusion, is a grill. So in the front of the car, it's got this big black area, which is supposed to give you the impression that there's a
radiator
grill
there. And yes, of course.
And this is fascinating, again, because why did you create this? How was it? Skeuomorphism design?
Right.
Yeah, so the Tesla is a skeuomorphic car. It's made to look like a real car, when in fact it doesn't have to look like a real car. It can look like anything you want it to, because it now doesn't, it breaks with the constraints it used to have. And yet it has a grill, it has a bonnet, it has a certain sleek nature to it that is probably unnecessary. And I wonder about the logic of that. I think that but again, the answer comes back this way. This is my hypothetical answer, is number one, they had a car designer design it, and they had a car marketer sort of think about how would you sell it, right, given the audience. And so they actually are leading from convention and the market, what they think the market will buy, rather than being truly engineering design-led. What is the best packaging options we have here? So, you know, you could have ended up with a minivan, actually. Ideally, I would think that a minivan would be the most logical shape, which means a one box, not a three box. And in this case, by the way, it's the back isn't quite a trunk. It's kind of like a hatchback, but it has sweeping curves that make it very plausible to be a trunk. And so it's fascinating how you make this decision that you're building a car that is not constrained by electromechanical or even just mechanical combustion engine, and yet you build it to evoke that product.
Well, I think you're really talking about risk, right? Both for the creator, the manufacturer, as well as the buyer. And I want to pass along a article from an area you're familiar with. There was interview with a longtime Boston car dealer recently named Herb Chambers. And a lot of different things in the article, but I thought he was spot on here. He said, there's always a certain fear in buying a new car. You ask yourself, did I get the right price? And he's focusing on the transaction here. Did I get a fair trade-in on my old car? Did I pick the right dealer? And that's with a new car. That apprehension can be 10 times worse with a used car. And he talked about having a fixed price deal. You can bring it back in 5 days, and then in 25 days, if you don't like it, you can bring it back if it has less than 1,500 miles on it and trade it for the same price for something else. So what you're getting at with Tesla is both the, you know, let's say the manufacturer, the creator perspective on risk, on product risk and sales risk, and then you going through the checklist and saying, all right, here are the things that matter to me, and you know, ultimately you said no. So it's an interesting question. The last thing I read recently was Ford is experimenting in Australia with a lifetime cap on service costs, which is fascinating to me. Sure. So apparently cars built after 07, they have a cap on what you will pay on a lifetime. Now, again, the small print and all these things, you know, could be important, but it's interesting that they're sort of, you know, looking at this transaction cost, when in fact, in my view, the market is changing even faster than that, given the Uber example of just take me from here to there. I don't really want to deal with owning a car or driver's license and all that. So what does that tell us about Tesla? Did they simply aim too low?
You could imagine so much more could have happened in terms of innovation, right? They, like we talked before, they could have innovated in the production system. And I've always maintained that the true disruptions in the car sector occur on production innovation. First being Ford with the Ford production system, then General Motors with the flexible production system, then Toyota with the Toyota production system. Mm-hmm. And all of these productions caused a shift in the economic foundations of the industry. And here comes Tesla and says, no, we do not have any production innovation, even though I think they could have gone down that road. They chose to say that powertrain is somehow innovative, and yet powertrain has never been the cause of disruption. Secondly, you could have done something with design, because the new powertrain might allow you to build it, and you could have produced differently, designed differently, and certainly they've changed sales, but not marketing. So they said you can only buy through us, and we don't have a dealer network. But they did not say that we will think about the job to be done differently. And that's what I really consider the core of marketing and design ultimately as well. But the idea of capturing a job to be done and running with it. They said, nope, the job to be done is the same. The production system is the same. The design job is the same, right? The car designer thinks about aesthetics in the auto industry. The car designer does not think what a car is ultimately for. That design, when what a car is ultimately for, that's what begat the Volkswagen Beetle, so Dr. Porsche's invention. That's what begat the Mini, the Renault 4, which was the first hatchback. All these packaging innovations and concepting innovations, and even Lee Iacocca in the minivan. You know, all of these ideas of new form factors were positioned on the job problems. Like, oh, people don't really need a sleek sports car. What they need is to get the kids to school. And so you want to have sliding doors and essentially a van, but comfortable enough to be a car. And on it goes, right? These were the real breakthroughs. Instead, we ended up with Tesla having a very, very, very conventional car. Just tragically conventional, in my opinion. So that's where I wonder. Now, you could say, okay, it's early days. The other thing I learned is I asked, does this, should I wait, given that this Model S is the current model, and you know, I know you're coming with Model X next year, but I heard that there's a sort of a cheaper car coming. Should I wait for that? Because I'm not really interested in an $80,000 car. And his answer was, oh, no, that's not going to be around until 2017 at the earliest. So well, that's another symptom of the problem is that they did not innovate on cycle time. They did not innovate because they didn't innovate on production. They did not innovate in how do we get end models quickly into a pipeline. With a production system that was based on something like Gordon Murray's iStream, you could have done that. With iStream, it's a matter of software to change a production system. You actually literally can pre-program what comes out of the plant, and so that could have been done. But they chose to be very conservative and use sheet metal and beat up on sheet metal with big machines. So that's why I'm finding it a not disruptive approach. It might do fine. It might do very well. Given the cycle time, also, they might be on the right side of the equation, because if the cycle time is 20 years in the industry, and we're not going to see any dramatic change for 20 years, they're going to have a good 10-year run.
Right. They're in the game. It doesn't matter. They'll get there.
Yeah. So that's why I've always felt that it was never sufficiently asymmetric, except again, on the sales thing. And that might be decisive.
So related to that, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago. Their auto editor is leaving or retiring, and he interviewed a guy named Sandy Monroe, who runs a firm outside of Detroit that takes apart cars and benchmarks them, looks at the cost, the processes. And so the car that he was taking apart was the BMW i3. And there were quite a few things in the article that caught my attention. The first thing he said was, I've never seen anything like this car. And he talked about how, well, it still has the old Henry Ford model of frame and body. He said it's carbon fiber. They can change the appearance, the aesthetics very quickly without changing the underlying drive components, right? And he said, this car makes money. He said, it's the only one I know in this genre that will make money, which I find very interesting. And then you also said that the batteries were designed to be useful as a power source as well. You know, so if solar hits, and we've talked about that in previous eSIM cards, that you could store them in these car batteries and then obviously use them both for the car and for other purposes. So maybe maybe the older player has jumped ahead in this battle. What do you think?
Yeah, well, it could. That's the thing, is that there's nothing to prevent them. There's no disincentive to run along with this idea, or run ahead, or run with this idea, generally speaking, because you have this proof of value that Tesla might be showing you, and so you build, you say, oh, okay, well, they've shown the way, so we'll follow. There's nothing illegal about that. Where disruption happens is when the entrant comes in a way of doing things that's completely it changes the fundamental economics, so you have disincentive to follow in that direction. So that's why you have asymmetric competition. So anyway, that's what struck me, and why I'm not going to make a call on that, on their prospects in as a business, as a successful business. What I would say, though, is that it's unlikely that they will change an industry to look as or cause the industry to change dramatically from what it is today. It's entirely consistent with that. One more detail about the test drive is that, as I said, there might be something to this software thing, that the idea that the car is a connected product, and in that sense, it's a lot better, a lot smarter than what we have today. But again, there's a question as to why automakers would not do this themselves. It's, I think that's more about failure to execute and lack of
vision.
That they modularized. They kept integrated a lot of parts of the car, so the engine, the chassis, the running gear, and the body, and all these things are integrated and interdependent. So they're not happy to farm out those components, right? As a firm, but they are very happy to farm out a lot of the electronical. Or electronics. And even if they're not, they tend to be very stodgy in their ways, which is why we've had very poor innovation going on in the in-car electronics. And that's where I think Tesla did kind of move quite a far distance ahead. Having said that, there are some issues with it. Number one, because it's always on a 3G network, it may not roam very comfortably. I mean, how do you manage the question? It's not an issue here so much in North America, but it might be. Let's say you go to Canada. Is the 3G coverage something that they pay
essential,
for?
Right? It's essential.
Yeah,
or not.
And they told me that if you take that car out of the U.S., and you drive and you move to another country, perfectly legal to do so. You can move the car and pay your taxes and do whatever you have to. I've done this. I've done this with two cars in my life. I've moved across borders and taken the car with me. But in this case, they said that the warranty would not extend. If you bought the car in the U.S., it would not be covered in a different country. Not because they couldn't fix mechanically the problems, but because exactly these electronics, and that the 3G, and I asked specifically about the 3G network, and then he said that, yeah, the 3G would not work in another country.
Can't swap out the SIM, Horace, too bad.
Well, I don't know. Maybe some hacks will be possible.
Right.
He gave an example of a buyer that had bought a car and took it to some country in the Middle East, and it got into either an accident or something catastrophically failed on it. And that owner shipped it back to the United States to have it repaired. But that's one extreme case because there wasn't anyone locally. But these days, you see how global brands, through the dealership networks and through independent mechanic service stations, what have you, are able to repair because they can get their hands on the parts and they can get their hands on the instructions and the manuals and the test equipment, all that stuff. That's been globalized. In the case of Tesla, it's, here's a car that's so far ahead in many ways, and yet it's so provincial in many other ways that you can't actually take it across borders, which seems very poorly thought through, right? They did, on the positive side, they did say that the supercharger network is growing very rapidly, and it's growing very rapidly also in Europe. And you know, they're opening a new one every couple of days. It's all good. But as we talked also before, even if you have a supercharger, the car still takes 20-30 minutes to get any significant fuel refuel.
Right. Well, the latest scheme is, I believe they're experimenting in California with battery swaps.
Sure. So. That would be a lot better. Mm-hmm. But the problem
doesn't
is
doesn't seem cycle. Simple either. I mean, it's but a lot, this, a lot of batteries.
So here, let's talk about that. For one thing, is that if you went to today to a regular service station, or let's call it a gas station, there's 150. Steve Crandall shared this information with me. There's 150,000 gas stations in the United States. Of those, about, I think, two-thirds, and I just forgot now, but it was either half or two-thirds of them have been converted to being also convenience stores, right? So this is an interesting, this has been an interesting trend, is that gas stations are getting a complete rebuilding into places where you fuel
right,
up.
A destination, yeah, exactly.
Well, completely you stop different. For gas, but you also stop to buy your snacks. In New England, we've got a famous Dunkin' Donuts that now, sells donuts and coffee inside of a gas station. Not to mention, so they're convenience stores. They're the what used to be the corner store, and now there's several important facts about that. Number one is that people are willing to invest in the infrastructure of gas station as an owner of that gas station because you're going to make high margin on this new product, which is the convenience store product lines. And that's happening globally, right? So whereas the old gas station used to be a place where you had a lift where the car was getting serviced. So you know, it was a combination of mechanics shop and fuel. Now it's no longer the fix. You don't go to a gas station and get your car tuned up or inspected. There's a few old stations still do that, but the newer ones have been, you know, completely remodeled as convenience stores. Now, that's interesting because the job to be done of the driver has changed. The idea of stopping for fuel has now become stop for fuel and get some gas or get some
coffee
food
or something.
Coffee and other things. So, right, that makes a lot of sense, right, that if you're stopping, you might as well stop once and get two things at once, get food and fuel. And this is very, very important because when you're stopping at a gas station, you're going to get this your electric car recharged. Then it's a 20-minute stop or something like that. And you, in the meantime, you get the food as well. However, bearing in mind that as you stop and you wait for the fueling to happen, you're taking up a slot in the station, and you have to watch how many cars go through a gas station. So during a typical day, and what are the peak rates? So you don't want to have people waiting. People tend to not like the idea of, you know, having to wait. And if you wait to get your car filled, you're waiting for a 5-minute loop, right, for the person to pump the gas, pay, and leave. But if you're waiting and that pump happens to be a supercharger, you're not going to wait 20 minutes per car, right? You're going to be looking at three cars ahead of you. That means you're going to be waiting an hour.
Exactly.
So that's not going to work, right?
No.
So that means you got to put a lot of superchargers next to each other, like you would pumps.
Right.
But how many of them? Then you realize that the space you need for parking the car is crucial. So you have to have a large surface area for the gas station in order to accommodate electric cars. Not just have one supercharger that gets occupied for 20 minutes per car. If you have 50 cars coming through in an hour, you've got a problem, right?
Work.
You can't serve. Yeah. So, or if you're looking at something like on the interstate highways outside of the cities, you see the parking lots are huge. But that's because people are going in for the rest area. They're going to use the bathroom. They're going to, you know, buy some stuff and get some gas. And imagine, you know, those were all those parking spots would have to be taken up with the supercharger. So it's not just having two pumps, aka superchargers per roadside stop. It's having 100 possibly, or 30 or 40. And that changes the economics of the gas station. So the gas station, on one hand, could find ways of saying, well, you come to my place, you get your car filled with electricity, but also you sit down for a meal. And then the meal becomes something like that takes an hour, so you feel better about sitting around. But then you got to be a restaurant, not a convenience store.
Right. So more overhead, more staff.
It's all very, very interrelated. Whereas if you had a short fuel stop, which you might get with a hydrogen pumping station, then the economics for the attendant or for the owner of the gas station is this: do I shell out for a restaurant and for more parking spots? Do I buy more land, or do I sink a hole in the ground and put in a hydrogen pump? Or sorry, a hydrogen tank, and then some other hardware that I need to compress it and convert from a natural gas pipeline, which already comes into my facility.
Right.
So I have a natural gas pipeline. I tap into it, and I produce on site. I produce hydrogen.
Yes.
And then I pump it, and I do all that stuff. So now that could cost a lot in CapEx, but doesn't take any real estate. It doesn't take me a new building to build, and I don't have to change the cycle time of my business. So that's a very interesting take on it, because it's not the supercharger network just being there doesn't solve the refueling problem. It doesn't get the job to be done of what people anticipate fueling to be. Now, having said that, people say, well, I'm not going to fuel anywhere at the gas station. I'm going to fuel at home. Well, fine. That's going to be that's, I think, the Tesla logic. But they're still where they are putting superchargers. Why are they doing superchargers in the first place? Because for long distance travel, right? And so there's this kind of like this kind of schizophrenic answer. It's like you're going to establish a supercharger network, but then you don't want people to supercharge because that's not really what the car is for. It's meant to be used at home. So there is I think a little bit of dissonance here. The bottom line is when you analyze the system, here's what I just as a wrap. Firstly, don't just study the vehicle. Study the entire system that the vehicle belongs to. The fueling system, the power system, the energy system, and the actual roads that the network that it has to ride on. And when you start to look at all this and all the interdependencies between them, then you start to see weaknesses in business plan. That's been always the thesis.
I think you're touching on the range anxiety aspect of EVs, and I know when I drove the i3 about a year ago, BMW said that they would have a deal if you needed a long distance car, that they would give you a quote or provide access to a conventional car for your longer drives if you're driving to Philadelphia or Charlotte or something, or Texas. So I think, again, thinking about the jobs to be done and avoiding those long waits where you're sitting there at the supercharger so you can continue your trip or waiting for the battery swap or whatever.
But all of that costs money. And
exactly.
Work only when
exactly.
You've got a very limited clientele.
Yes.
A lot of these things that people are gloating who have these cars because the experience is so great. Well, their experience is so great because they're paying
$80,000.
Right. They everyone is treating them like they're somehow benefactors to the global
global good, whatever that is.
Whatever. It's like, so they feel great. They said, you got to have one of these. But then when everybody has one of these, it's not going to feel at all the same way. It's just that I'm trying to see how things might actually evolve And one of the things they also promise you when you're a Tesla owner is that if you do have a mechanical or a repair issue, that they're going to give you a loaner for free, and so on. But there's still, at the time I last checked, there were only 550 cars, such cars, Teslas, in use in the whole state of Massachusetts. And, you know, they have one retail outlet, which is actually it's a showroom in one mall in the suburbs of Boston. And that's it. You know, there's maybe one supercharger somewhere nearby. And so it all sounds great until you realize that it's a very, very niche thing. And, you know, the production figures show it. It's in the tens of thousands, where, you know, globally the market is in the 60 million unit range,
right?
Not including trucks or buses.
Yeah, this article on the i3 mentioned, you know, that it has a long way to go. They mentioned the 3 Series global volume this year is 500,000 cars. You know, it doesn't seem like a luxury car anymore.
Is that the 3 Series?
Yes, 3 Series around the world, 500,000 cars this year.
That's a lot.
Think about that.
That's a lot. Yeah. You know, BMW used to be a lot smaller. Right.
But the other thing that I read, interestingly, and again, not far from you in Boston, Rhode Island cut a deal with a company. And to me, this tells you sort of the regulatory and tax pressure that's hitting the auto ecosystem. So they cut a deal with a company in South Carolina called Motor Vehicle Solutions. And the idea is they would create a database provided by the car insurance companies and then compare that with the state auto registration database. And essentially then they would go and say, oh, Jim, you don't have car insurance. Here's your bill. Here's your fee. And they keep the money, right? So there's a sort of an odd public-private deal there to mine that data and go after those who don't have insurance. And I think they said 18% or something like that. So again, that combined with maybe these pay by the mile or pay by the kilometer taxes that are being floated would seem to add yet more pressure on the traditional game, and may simply accelerate the ride sharing. And I want to, you know, we're getting sort of toward the end, and it is Christmas time as we record this. So I have to deliver a bit of news, and last the previous ASIM car, Horace, we talked about why somebody would destroy their brands. Mm-hmm. And apparently over the last year, Porsche has been floating this sort of 914 style shared car with Audi and Volkswagen, sort of a son of Boxster or entry level Porsche. But we heard news, I think last week, that they have killed the idea once again. You know, every 5 or 10 years they float this, so they're not going to go further down market.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to me that, you know, is that either simply recognizing your brand, or is it that we already have these SUVs, that's where the money is, so who cares about sports cars? Are sports cars dead?
Well,
or,
yeah, sports cars are certainly an endangered species.
Yes.
I would say so. And some of the feedback we got from the last show was saying things like, well, I think the Porsche making SUVs, not just one, but several,
right,
and making a four-door Panamera
big
type
car, S-Class competitor,
is perfectly rational and wise, because the emerging markets, or namely China, maybe perhaps Russia as well, although not so much anymore, I think, next year, but it's been for a while that those were large markets for them. Those folks could not make use of a tiny little eccentric sports car like the 911, and so the purists may balk at the brand extension into SUVs, but it's a completely necessary thing. The way we argued it was that it was not that it was a an extravagance. I didn't want to criticize, and I don't want to criticize the idea that that you should not make it because it's impure. I have no purity problems. What I'm saying is only that the meaning of brand, the essence of it, and what it makes it unique and distinguished, and therefore valuable, is that it solves a particular job. And I felt that the job of Porsche was performance. And it was something that you couldn't get. Even if you make an SUV or minivan, let's say minivans would have been the absolutely hottest item today. It was a great movie, Get Shorty, where I don't know if you remember.
Of course.
The protagonist gets in a minivan by complete mistake, not because they didn't have anything else at the car rental, and then he becomes popular, and right. Everyone in Hollywood drives minivans. Mm-hmm. So it could have been that Chinese billionaires suddenly got a hankering for minivans, and suddenly Porsche would have to make them, and then we would argue not so much about SUVs, but about this new minivan craze. And so my point is simply that it's what if it was not just minivans, not just SUVs, but every other crossover, weird shape and size and thing that you had to have because that's what made the market. Well, sure. If you do that and if everybody does that, yes, you're going to make your numbers. But as you do that, you slowly corrode and erode what it really means to be Porsche. And that's where in the long, long term, and that may not be 5 years, maybe not 10 years, but as we've talked about the way Cadillac was shaped by its brand, dilution, you end up with the brand that doesn't mean anything at all. And so those very wealthy people who bought your Porsche SUVs are going to switch over to a local manufactured SUV because the Porsche brand doesn't
have the cachet anymore.
Cachet, and it'll be, it'll be Chery Motors or whatever is the name of the latest Chinese manufacturer that's going to capture the cachet of being performance-driven. And by the way, they'll get there because they're going to probably build these iconic products. Again, it's the reputations are built, and brands are reputations, and they're being built on like Tesla today is building on this shape that they have on innovation in that particular genre. But it's something that's easily lost. Like we talked about Mini, same thing. Mini was built on a very tiny Mini car. It was packaged in a way that made it brilliant, and that's what established them. And if they end up with obese cars that are branded Mini, maybe it's not such a...
Well, they're shooting for a million. Brand. They're shooting for a million, Horace. So
they're shooting for a million a year, is that right?
Yes, globally.
Well, is that a good thing? Why? I mean, what's wrong with 300,000 good cars? I understand the need for growth, but it's about sustainability. And the data I just published on my Asimco blog, which shows in the smartphone space that you have these waves of... because smartphones are such a short cycle time product, they can see patterns very quickly. You can see a pattern where an entrant comes in and just shoots to the top of the charts and then plummets right after. And it seems like it's happened 5 times in the phone business. And so now, will it happen in a car business? I don't know. But I'm not yet convinced that you should always do that which the market directs you to do. Yes, the market directs you to make SUVs, but should you do it? That's where I really struggle. And sometimes I ask, if you are going to do it, maybe you're better off doing it with a partner or a brand that lets you stay positioned on the job to be done. That's performance, let's say. Even though performance may not be fashionable anymore. But you've got to do that because performance is that thing which lets you stay in the sweet spot of profitability.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think BMW's is a fascinating company to watch because on the one hand they have 500,000 3 Series sales globally this year apparently, and at the same time they somehow spawned the i3 and the i8. So it'll be interesting to see if the antibodies kick in and kill the new thing or not.
it's like. There's Audi, which came out of... I remember when there used to be one Audi,
right.
Audi 2000.
Right.
Well, we're told that by 2016, there are going to be 60 different Audi models.
Yeah.
60. Not six, not three. Mm-hmm. And same with... And I think that's probably going to happen for BMW and Mercedes.
Oh, yeah. BMW released a front-drive minivan that's two active tour, but it's a 5 or 7 passenger minivan.
and to me, the Mercedes could and does, I think, succeed as an SUV. The G-Wagen and then ultimately the M series cars. So they're fine to me, but when they try to get into the A and the minivans and the front-wheel drive mini cars, hatchbacks, that's where I'm starting to wonder if that brand should stretch there. And you know, in Europe it's different because Europe, Mercedes is also on trucks and buses, and it's a very utility brand. It's on taxis and
right.
That's fine. But when you go to really ultra cheap, even they didn't put it on their smart car. The smart car is a sort of the super small car, but that's branded smart. That has its own sub brand. So that's where I'm struggling with kind of positioning on this whole spectrum. So anyway, that's just as a follow up to our
endless podcast. Line extension. Yes. Well, yeah. Again, great show, Horace, and we'll look forward to 21 in the future.